this is a session that will serve as an introduction to the rest of the sessions for this week. And I know that most of you are here Saturday night, and so you did get an introduction to the questions. But really, I don't know how you can easily get into this material in just 1 hour. So let's have another crack at it from another vantage point. And I begin with several quotations from scriptures of various traditions. And see, just saying scriptures, that is holy books of other traditions, raises questions, doesn't it? It certainly raises questions in the exclusivist Christian mind. Scriptures. Nevertheless, this first quotation from the Bhagavad Gita, one of the holy books of the Hindu tradition, in which the blessed Lord is speaking, and the blessed Lord is known as Krishna. The blessed Lord said, "Attach thy mind to me. Engaged in yogic exercise, put thy trust in me. This doing, listen how thou mayest come to know me in my entirety, all doubt dispelled. This wisdom derived from sacred writ and the wisdom of experience I shall proclaim to thee, leaving nothing unsaid. This knowing, never again will any other thing that needs to be known remain. Among thousands of men, but one, maybe, will strive for self-perfection. And even among these athletes who have won perfection's crown, but one, maybe, will come to know me as I really am. Eightfold divided is my nature. Thus, earth, water, fire and air, space, mind, and also soul and ego. This is the lower, but other than this, I have a higher nature. This too must thou know. And this is nature seen as life, by which this universe is kept in being. From these two natures, all beings take their origin. Be very sure of this. Of the whole wide universe, the origin of the dissolution too am I. Higher than I, there's nothing whatsoever. On me, the universe is strung like clustered pearls upon a thread. In water, I am the flavor. In sun and moon, the light. In all the Vedas, Om. Om, the sacred syllable. In space, I'm sound. In man, his manliness am I, or creatureliness. Pure fragrance in the earth am I, flames onset in the fire. And life am I and all contingent beings, in ascetics, their fierce austerity. Know that I am the eternal seed of all contingent beings, reason in the rational, glory in the glorious am I. Power in the powerful I, such power as knows nor passion nor desire. Desire am I in contingent beings, but such desire as is not at war with the right or dharma. Know too that all states of being, whether they be of nature's constituent goodness, passion, or darkness, proceed from me, but I am not in them, they are in me." We move from Hinduism to its historical complement, which is Buddhism, and a short description of the Bodhisattva ideal. And the Bodhisattva is the person who has achieved Satori, who has understood sunyata, the emptiness, that is sort of a Buddhist analogy for the real or the eternal or the non-contingent or God. One who has, as it were, looked over the wall and looked down and seen nirvana. And then instead of climbing over the wall and down into nirvana, climbs back down into the world, conceived of as a desert of ignorance, and comes back and helps people. In other words, the Bodhisattva in Buddhism is a savior. They are Bodhisattvas who live on from life to life in the possession of manifold good qualities. They are Bodhisattvas who have won the mastery over karma, and made their deeds renowned through their accumulation of merit. They are resolute and valiant, intent on endurance, trustworthy, upright, and sincere. They are generous, firm, gentle, tender, patient, whole and tranquil of heart, difficult to overcome and defeat, intent on what is real, charitable, and faithful to their promises. They are intelligent, brilliantly intelligent, gifted with insight and not given to gratification of sensual desires. They are devoted to the highest good. They win converts by means of sympathetic appeal. They are pure in conduct and clean of heart, full of exceeding great veneration, full of civility to elder and noble. They are resourceful in all matters, using conciliatory and agreeable methods, and in affairs of government they are adept in persuasive speech. They are men whose voice is not checked in the assembly, men who pour forth their eloquence in a mighty stream. With knowledge as their banner, they are skilled in drawing the multitude to them. They are endowed with equanimity, and their means of living is beyond reproach. They are men of successful achievements, and they are ready to come to the assistance of others and help those in distress. They do not become enervated by prosperity and do not lose composure in adversity. They are skilled in uprooting the vices of mean men. They are unwearying in clothing the nakedness of others. They are anxious not to blight the maturing of their karma, and they acquire the roots of virtue by keeping themselves aloof from passion, hatred, and folly. They are skilled in bringing solace to those in trouble and misfortune. They do not hesitate to render all kinds of service. In all matters, they are untiring in their purpose. They are endowed here in this world with the profound attributes of a Buddha. Now from China come two brief excerpts from sacred scriptures of Taoism, which resonates with Confucianism and also Shinto. So we're not only in China, but also in Japan. The first is, the universe flows from the Tao and goes like this. Well, I should explain that the Tao is not like a person as we conceive of God. Tao is more like a principle or a force that is moving in and among and through all things. So here is the universe flows from the Tao. There was something containing all. Before heaven and earth, it exists. Tranquil, oh. Incorporeal, oh. Alone it stands and does not change. It goes everywhere and is not hindered. It can thereby become the universe's mother. I know not its name. I characterize it by calling it the way. Forced to make a name for it, I call it the great. Great, I call the elusive. The elusive, I call the far. The far, I call the returning. And then the creation of the universe. Before heaven and earth had taken form, all was vague and amorphous. Therefore, it was called the Great Beginning. The Great Beginning produced emptiness, and emptiness produced the universe. The universe produced material force which had limits. That which was clear and light drifted up to become heaven, while that which was heavy and turbid solidified to become earth. It was very easy for the pure, fine material to come together, but extremely difficult for the heavy, turbid material to solidify. Therefore, heaven was completed first, and earth assumed shape after. The combined essences of heaven and earth became the yin and the yang. The concentrated essences of the yin and yang became the four seasons, and the scattered essences of the four seasons became the myriad creatures of the world. After a long time, the hot force of the accumulated yang produced fire, and the essence of the fire force became the sun. The cold force of the accumulated yin became water, and the essence of the water force became the moon. The essence of the excess force of the sun and moon became the stars and the planets. Heaven received the sun, moon, and stars, while earth received water and soil. The final quotation moves us from east to west intellectually and geographically, from the Far East to the Near East, to the Saudi or the Arabian Peninsula, now Saudi Arabia, where we hear a tradition or a hadith of the Prophet Muhammad. And this is a hadith, it's not in the Quran, but it's in the body of tradition that emerged after Muhammad's death, out of the natural curiosity people have about what the Prophet did and said and what his attitudes toward various things were. This is a hadith about the night journey or ascension of the Prophet Muhammad. It is related from Qatada, quoting from Anas ben Malik, with whom may Allah be pleased, from Malik ben Sasa'a, who said that the Prophet of Allah, on whom be Allah's blessing and peace, related to them the story of the night on which he was taken on his heavenly journey, saying, "While I was in Al-Khatim," or maybe he said, "While I was in Al-Hir, lying at rest, one came to me, split all between here and there, that is, from the hollow of his throat to his pubic hair, and drew out my heart. Then there was brought a golden basin filled with faith, in which he washed my heart and my bowels, and then they were returned to their place." According to another line of transmission, the Prophet said, "Then he washed my stomach with water of Zamzam," which is not mentioned in the Quran, but is a sacred well from which pilgrims on the pilgrimage drink even to this day. "Water of Zamzam, and filled it with faith and wisdom. Then a white riding beast was brought, somewhat smaller than a mule, yet bigger than an ass, whose every bound carried him as far as the eye could reach. Him I mounted, and Gabriel set off with me." Gabriel, by the way, is known as the Holy Spirit in the Quran. "Gabriel set off with me till we came to the lowest heaven, which he asked should be opened. 'Who is this?' he was asked. 'Gabriel,' he replied. 'And who is that with you?' 'Muhammad,' he said. 'And has he had revelation sent him?' 'Assuredly,' said he. 'Then welcome to him. How blessed a coming.' Thereat the gate was opened, and when I cleared it, lo, there was Adam. Gabriel said, 'This is your father Adam. Greet him.' So I gave him greeting, which he returned, saying, 'Welcome to you, O righteous son, righteous prophet.' Then Gabriel mounted up with me till we came to the second heaven, which he asked should be opened. 'Who is this?' he was asked. 'Gabriel,' he replied. 'And who is that with you?' 'Muhammad,' he said. 'And has he had revelation sent him?' 'Assuredly,' said he. 'Then welcome to him. How blessed a coming.' Thereat the gate was opened, and when I cleared it, lo, there were John the Baptist and Jesus, who were cousins on their mother's side. Said Gabriel, 'These are John and Jesus. Give them greeting.' So I greeted them, and they returned it, saying," now this is saying to Muhammad, "'Welcome to the righteous brother, the righteous prophet.' Then he ascended with me to the third heaven, which he asked should be opened. 'Who is this?' he was asked. 'Gabriel,' he replied. 'And who is with you?' 'Muhammad,' said he. 'And has he had revelation sent him?' 'Assuredly,' said he. 'Then welcome to him. How blessed a coming.' Thereat the gate was opened, and when I had cleared it, lo, there was Joseph. Gabriel said, 'This is Joseph. Greet him.' So I gave him greeting, which he returned, saying, 'Welcome to the righteous brother, the righteous prophet.'" And from there, Muhammad is said to have bounded on this white steed to Jerusalem, and the place where he landed and took off from back to Mecca, is the Haram al-Sharif, under one political persuasion, the Temple Mount, under another political aegis, and where the Dome of the Rock is today, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I want to say a couple of things about what we're doing in this room, because there might be some misapprehensions or misunderstandings about what our enterprise is. We are not doing constructive theology here. We are not thinking about a particular religious question within the confines of a particular religious tradition. So, for example, we could say, let us plumb the depths of the concept Allah according to various Islamic interpretations, Orthodox, for example, or Sufi. That would be doing theology. That would be doing Muslim theology. We are doing more of a preparatory kind of thing. In this room, we are taking our commitments, or at least I'm presenting the material in this way, and you can do whatever you darn well please. But I'm presenting the material in this way, that we take our commitments, which we live by and which we passionately hold as true, and put them on the shelf so that they are not either, in the first instance, coloring our understanding of what we're hearing and talking about. And in another instance, they're not put into the garbology pit, never to be seen again, right? Rather, we are taking our commitments, let's say our commitment to Jesus as the way, the truth, and the life, and putting it on a shelf. So it's still there, but if we are able then to step away from it in some kind of artificial sense, and this is a sort of artificial place in a way, and talk about these ideas as if we were free-thinking human beings that had all these options laid out in front of us, and we were kind of looking at them and saying, well, isn't this interesting? So theology, in a way, says this stuff is not only interesting, but it's true and morally compelling. That we're kind of putting on the shelf, and we're saying, well, let's pretend that we don't have these passionate commitments. Let's pretend that we want to start from zero and think through some of these issues in a plural society. Pluralistic world, really, not just society. I went to a bar one time. Of course, it was the only time. Ever. Ever. I realized the ALC history of this place. That's why I said that. In Fort Wayne, and which is not a destination resort, believe me. And I went to college there, and our system in the Lutheran Church Missouri system was that you went to a junior college for the first 2 years, like Portland. No, I went to Milwaukee. And then all of those people from all of those prep schools got together and spent the last 2 years of college at Concordia Senior College. And then we all went on to the seminary in St. Louis. So we're all sort of trained in the same mode. Well, I went to this bar, and when I first arrived in Fort Wayne as a junior, and I sat next to a guy who had graduated from the seminary and was back, I don't know why, but, you know. And because of the subsequent history of that seminary, no wonder he was knocking them back. He said to me, after we started our conversation, he said, forget everything you learn here in the Tassem. Just go back to the catechism. Well, this is the counterexample of what I'm talking about here. All of the historical criticism that he learned at the seminary and about which Berger is teaching us in the morning, you know, he recognized, I think, intuitively that if he took that stuff seriously, he would have to reevaluate his naive view of Bible or as of Bible and Lutheran confessional theology as encapsulated in the Catechism of Luther. You know, so in a sense, he was warning me, don't come into a room like this. And I didn't take his advice. And I'll...
Okay, that's it.
How very Holden of you.
Really.
Always open to new ideas.
And I'll... And as I read this paragraph from a book by Edward Hughes on Wilford Cantwell Smith, who is hugely influential in religious studies circles, you'll get a sense of why at least I'm glad that I didn't take this guy's advice in the bar, because it would have closed me off forever to a paragraph like this. I would have read a paragraph like this and said, you know, I wasted $12.50. Or however much this is. So this paragraph gives me a sense, and maybe it'll give you a sense of where I'm coming from. In this, oh, that was last session. The word share in this class will not be used in preference to the word tell. No. Okay. All right. The ancient fear of strange gods begs to be overcome. A new situation exists today in which faithful persons of all traditions face common possibilities for planetary cooperation. They share a recently acquired knowledge of millennia of humankind's religious activities. And I underline the word knowledge in here. It relates to what Berger is helping us see in terms of the Bible. Why is the King James Version no longer adequate for Christian study? Well, because the manuscripts with which the early 17th century worked have been great. That pile of manuscripts has gotten here, you know, and back then it was like this. In other words, we know more. And it's just very honest that we should say we know more than they did then. What's wrong with saying that? And so the Bible versions that we produce today are more adequate witnesses to the text, which we don't have, you know, the original text of the Bible, as it were, than was the King James Version. So we simply have more understanding of the world's religions in this case. They also share the ambivalent power of technology and the worldview of 20th century science. Persons of different religious communities are thrown together through instantaneous communication and the collective fear of nuclear annihilation. He's saying we live in a different world. And in this case, not just from 1611, but from 1945. And they come together in a new manner. Today, for the first time in history, persons meet with an accurate and agreed knowledge of the differences that exist between their respective traditions and outlooks. For the first time, I'll emphasize, they have the possibility of authentically understanding one another. I think that is significant. Because, as he says in the next paragraph, the common way for religions, and not just Christianity and Islam, but really for all religions to regard the other religions, has been in terms of domination, avoidance, and anathema. Or in the case of Hinduism, dogmatically asserting that all of the religions are really pointing toward the same ideas. So the pre-history of the history of religions and their interaction one with another has been characterized by, to a greater or lesser degree, ignorance. And now for the first time in history, we're able really to understand I think two basic things. One, the longevity of religions. I mean, in the first century, and I'm breaking in on Burgess territory here, but my sense is that, of course, Christianity emerged in a pluralistic religious situation. It wasn't done in a corner. I mean, there was a whole mall, as I said before. This tape knows that word. There was a mall of religions. You know, you could go down and pick your religion, or a bazaar, or a souk of religions. But you know, in at that time, I don't think the understanding was there of the depth of these traditions, of how long back in the midst of time goes the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedas. That Buddhism has a long history and, too, has produced saints and fanatics, which every religious tradition has produced. Every religious tradition has produced saints and fanatics. And I think that this paragraph is saying that now, for the first time in history, we are really confronted with the longevity and the vitality of these religious traditions. They are not evanescent, like, you know, the latest Gnosticism, or the latest version of Isisism or something. And as one person, or more than one, has said, the real challenge to Christianity is not the New Age. You know, it's not Islam, it's Buddhism. That Buddhism has a vitality and a worldview that is very attractive to people in the late 20th century, who realize that our attachment to things is killing us. That our speciesism and all that stuff is killing us. We've got to find a better way. Well, many people will say, well, we can find it in a Christian ecological spirituality, and I think Holden is exhibit A of that. You know, but others are giving up on Christianity because they see Christianity as an exemplar of the, and indeed a fundament of the Western worldview, which is killing the planet. So maybe we can find another way, and Buddhism presents itself as another way. They also come together, that is, religionists, come together with the knowledge that no society in history has solved the problem of interreligious coexistence, and that this is the novel task that awaits them. Now, if something in that paragraph got you thinking, if that is exciting to you, that sense of being in a new era, and of a theological task ahead of us, then you're a good candidate for staying in this room at least the rest of the hour. If not actually lurching back into this room the following days. All right, I'll stop there and see if there are any reactions.
I guess I was real skeptical about that selection that you just read. Maybe I didn't hear everything you said, but it sounded like it was saying that because people are realizing at long last that these other religions have existed for a long time, they're not just a passing fad, that then there will be more respect for other people's religions? That we'll be able to coexist together in a way that we have never been able to do before because suddenly we have some new perception?
If I understand what you're saying right, I think yeah.
Because I think that just what we know is not going to change our human nature, which is, of course, to assume that we're right and that people who are different from us are wrong.
Ah.
And that we therefore have to change them so that they won't be so threatening to
mm-hmm.
us.
Well, the very person that is reflected in this paragraph, William Cantwell Smith, thinks that there is no human nature.
Okay.
That human nature is culturally conditioned.
Okay.
Absolutely conditioned. Not just conditioned, absolutely. Yeah. Human nature has fallen or whatever, get reflected in other religions. That's a very interesting and potentially fruitful thing to do. But people like Smith are saying we have to go beyond that to the position of letting the other religious traditions criticize our understanding of what it means to be a human being. And not that they're going to win or we're going to lose. See, and this atmosphere that's created is a both-and atmosphere rather than an either-or. And that typology can be criticized too. In other words, we're putting it all on the shelf and starting over. Yeah.
That's already, this example of human nature is already beginning within Christianity as what you're describing. I was thinking of this creation spirituality, Matthew Fox, where there's a different viewpoint of what human nature is versus from fallen, sinful humans to.
Mm-hmm. But there's a way to understand that creation spirituality within the old paradigm. And the old paradigm might be right, but there's a kind of essentialist bias in the old paradigm that, you know, when you pare it all down, there's something there. It's not the infinite onion, but there is something. When you peel it all away, there's something there. And what's there is both an emphasis on the fallen nature of humanity, which Matthew Fox says is overemphasized. He doesn't want to get rid of it, I don't think. Because it's a counterbalance to a kind of Gnostic optimism that says we're little gods and we can do anything we want. Well, that's hubris. That's overweening pride, right? But he says, let's not emphasize that to the detriment of the understanding that we are created good. And God, you know, dusted off her hands or whatever and said, it is good. And that we are made in the image of God, which is very much emphasized in the Orthodox tradition. That the divine shining in us has been darkened or by sin, but really we can become divinized. That's creation spirituality according to the Orthodox. So that's within the perimeters. Perimeters is kind of a buzzword too. It means the same as perimeters, by the way. You learned that first here. I mean, we all know what a perimeter is, but if somebody has parameter, you say, what the cop is a perimeter? You know, I never met one of those. I know what a perimeter is. It's a limit. So within the limits of the old dogmatics, you can get a creation spirituality confected. Mark likes that word. Out of it.
Sounds sweet.
Very good. But, you know, what if you put on the shelf the old dogmatics and start out with the idea of self, for example, or person. So you move in another direction with that. Let's see. Yeah. You had.
Thinking about the boundaries, I've been trying to digest this and thinking about the boundaries that were once there, the natural boundaries as far as distance, as he talked about the technology and whatever, have evaporated. And what was once kind of comfortable, we were isolated within ourselves, and it was comfortable to believe everything, to believe that this was the only way. But those things are gone, and now we're noticing the commonalities, not just now, but you know, in the early 20th century, what have you. And it's time to think about this and see that. But yet the boundaries within our mind are still there, and I think that's what you're talking about too, is breaking those down, and not accepting necessarily, but entertaining those ideas and seeing what kind of commonalities you do have.
Right. And Cantwell Smith is very strong on saying you can't just encounter ideas, you have to encounter persons. And that flows from what you're saying. Not only technically do we know more, but we know actual people. You know, our sons and daughters are marrying these actual others. They're not just over there. I mean, and quickly, you know, as the clock ticks, the Jews are not reproducing at an astoundingly descending rate. And the Muslims are producing at an astoundingly ascending rate. And they're going to be the majority Semitic tradition, say the Christians, in this country in a very few years. So, you know, you're much more likely to run into a Muslim as you are likely to run into a Jew in pretty short order, historical order. So these, you know, we are encountering people as the other that we thought of as the, you know, the big other over there. Now there are these others, and is it possible to have an understanding of the other that makes them less of the other and turns them into another? Another one of me, but a different me, a different I, but not antithetical. Now, the traditional Christian understanding runs counter to that, I think. It is, in a sense, an objectification of the other. The other, in order to become another, needs to become like me. Now, that might be right. That's on the shelf, see? Down here, below the shelf, we're saying, what? It's even higher than you. You're on the shelf. Curious, looking down from the shelf. way up there is that idea that maybe they have to become like me. In other words, they have to name the name, other than which there is no name given by which we must be saved. But what if they don't? See, what does that do to our Christian theology? What does that do to our moral stance? And what does it do to missionary activity? I think those are the two scariest areas when we talk about relativism. That if we allow the possibility of plural approaches to salvation, that we cut the nerve of morality and missionary activity. Because they are based on absolutes. Not that we grasp the absolute, but we can not that we comprehend the absolute, but we can apprehend at least enough of the absolute so that we can be pretty absolutely sure that you shouldn't do X, or you better be doing Y. And you better be drawing other people out of other cultures and traditions toward that flaming center, as Karl Broughton calls it. Now, what if you put that on the shelf and say that there are plural truths? That there are plural sources of truth, there are plural ultimates. And this is what the process folks want to see. You know, it's one thing to say, well, you have these phenomena which are multiple that reflect in some, to some degree or another, the ultimate, the numinous, which is one. Now that fits pretty comfortably with a kind of liberal understanding of the other religion. But what if that one is itself multiple? See? Now, is that going to get the bucks flowing into the ELCA coffers on West Higgins Road? Like you said this, somebody said this morning. Oh,
Catherine
said, you know, give to the mission budget.
Not if
well, I don't know.
Push Lutheranism, you're not going to
get mine. But hasn't the nature of missions in the Lutheran Church already changed and been changing, that it's no longer so much going out and converting the world, and it's more like building hospitals and doing Christ-like things,
mm-hmm.
like helping people.
Yeah. And see, that, from one point of view, that really undercuts this discussion, because this discussion kind of takes seriously truth claims in a philosophical sense. There's one way to view what you're talking about as not taking those seriously at all, mm-hmm. and just saying that praxis precedes intellection or putting together ideas. And that quickly can lead to not putting them together at all and just going out there and changing the world for the better. You know, kind of 19th century liberal optimistic theology. Now we call it liberation theology. But it's the same stuff, you know. It's the manifestation of the kingdom of God that Jesus preached, the Jesus of history preached. So, you know, I don't know. That fits in with the spirit of the liberal age, doesn't it? So, yeah.
This missionary thing, you know, we've been trying to get these other people into our clothes for so long that it's really difficult for us to stop doing that. You know, you Indian over there, you, why do you wear those things? I mean, it's unchristian to run around in a loincloth or whatever they did in the past. And we're still doing that to the Indians. And everywhere we go, we just keep mucking it up. And I keep saying, how can I stop feeling guilty if I'm not out witnessing for Christ? That's the whole missionary thing. I mean, we're supposed to go out there and be missionaries for Christ. When was the last time you invited somebody to church? Have you heard that lately?
Mm-hmm.
And how can we bring them in,
Yeah.
All this stuff. And every time we do it, we garbage up their thing. I mean, the Indians were doing their thing. And we just keep mucking it up. We wrecked their culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the answer to that is that you have to stop being ignorant. You have to step back and study other people before you decide to go.
But you can't know enough. You can't know enough. I just found out, I was just reading a book, it's just a little thing that some Indian lady wrote, and that's why I was thinking Indian, it could be anybody.
Native American
Indians, and they sterilized those women. When they would go in and have a baby, they'd sterilize the Indian women. We don't have more Indians, I mean, good heavens. And I didn't know that. They're still doing that. The scientific American Western go to the hospital and have your baby people.
But I still say the key to that is knowledge.
Yeah, but how can you know enough? I mean,
well, then before you do something to somebody else, you have to question that.
But we do it without
Okay, give us a fuller explanation.
Uninterrupted.
Okay.
of what you mean by you got to know.
Well,
where do you want to go with that?
As I understand the discussion is we're taking, it not only applies, these discussions like this about, as our ideas, religious, economic, socially, otherwise, develop, to survive, in earlier times, we built borders, walls around them so that they could grow. Now what's happened is that those borders are, that's a good word,
sorry.
Are stagnating. They are keeping us from further growth. So you have to lower those barriers and you have to look outside and you have to study those other cultures and find out what's going on there. We have to do this in religion, we have to do it economically, or we will die. Our borders will kill us. They will keep us in and we won't be able to grow. That's what I mean by knowledge. That you have to go out there and you have to find out before you press on, because it is true that you might go out there and find a better way.
Okay, that is the risk of dialogue, that you might find a better way, or more realistically, you might find a moderated or nuanced way that you're already on. But you can read it another way, which our fundamentalist and hardcore evangelical friends would find quite congenial. Yes, you have to know other cultures. Yes, you have to break down the barriers, comma, in order so that once you understand them, you can present the gospel more winsomely to them, comma, so that then they will leave what they're in and come into our porous, yes, but still erected walls. Now, this material is challenging the very premise of that, and I, you know, don't know where you want to go with that, but that's where some people would want to go. Just like they'd want to say, historical, grammatical criticism of the Bible. See,
Historical critical? No. Because it undercuts the foundations of the faith. Yeah?
I'm sufficiently confused that I'm almost certain that when I get through talking, I'll be wish I hadn't opened my mouth. One, I'm looking for a connection between your approach on Saturday night and today. Two, I'm concerned that for some who came Saturday night, their reaction was, you speak a language which is really for the theological student and not for the lay person, the average person. Two, you do not affirm your own faith in Jesus Christ as Lord of your life sufficiently to satisfy some. And then you distributed this book review of Newbegin's book, and I was intrigued by some of the comments in that. On the one hand, Newbegin, who's, I think, pretty conservative, not like Berger, Peter Berger, but the sociologist that he reacts to. But he says, we Christians, and Newbegin, incidentally, is this Anglican bishop who has been in South Africa and various places, and I think is...
India, isn't he? South India, excuse me.
And is quite a thinker about the church. Now, he says, on the one hand, as we confront the other religions, we need to see that we look through our own glass, and we must somehow put that aside. We must somehow look beyond or recognize that it's not possible for us, except through the prism of our own Christianity, to look at these other religions. On the other hand, he takes strong issue with those he calls liberals, who would simply put aside our Christian faith in Jesus as the Christ in order to have dialogue with these other religions. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to have dialogue with the other religions. I don't want to put aside my Christian faith. At the same time, I think I sum up my understanding, and I'll close with this, with something I heard years ago, that for me, Jesus is the Christ, and he seems to me to be the one who satisfies the universal human hunger. Now, that may go farther than most can go if they get in the dialogue, but I think we can enrich ourselves and others in the dialogue, whether or not we change very much in our own thinking about the Christian faith. And so I want to encourage that. But I'm still having these problems along the way. One, can we do this in language for the laity? Two, can we do this and affirm our Christian faith in Jesus as Lord?
Well, I've always prided myself in being able to get concepts across to lay people, being a former lay person myself. And you know, I'm from Hammond, Indiana. I didn't grow up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So a lot of this stuff comes to me, you know, as rather strange stuff. It's just that there were certain things in my background which I found that I could not say anymore with a straight face. And so it was a matter of integrity for me to struggle to something else. And I think I found some kind of place as a point of departure. But, you know, as you depart on Newt on Friday or Saturday or Sunday or whenever you're leaving, Newt the bus, I hope you too will maybe have struggled through to some point of departure, but certainly not a omega point of closure. The other thing I would say relative to what you said is that the encounter with others is inevitable. So we don't have to advocate encounter, religious encounter, interreligious encounter. That's a fait accompli, it's a fact, it's there it is. The question is, how do we shape the encounter? And these folks, the Cantwell Smiths and others, are saying, let's shape it as a dialogue. And to say it's an encounter is to say something different from it's a dialogue. Because dialogue means that you come in your particularity, not in some point. You know, Archimedes said, if you give me a point outside the world, I can move the world. I can have leverage if I can just get out of history or out of whatever boxes me in. See, well, there is no Archimedean point. There is no universal that's immediately apprehendable. And this is one of the learnings, I think, from religious studies, that one encounters the universal in the particular. I mean, I don't become a universal person just because I understand that, you know, Krishna and Christ function in many people's lives in sort of the same way. Well, I'm not going to say, well, that's interesting, so, you know, on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I'm going to study the Upanishads, and then, you know, the other days I'll study the Bible. I mean, you don't homogenize yourself that way. Rather, dialogue says, in the World Council of Churches sense, we sit down without any preconceptions about who is grasped by or who has grasped the truth. And we open ourselves to our understanding, as you say, Jesus as Savior and Lord, to being at least nuanced, if not substantially changed. Now, if we believe that the truth has grasped us in Jesus, if we really believe that, and we understand the historical conditionedness of saying that, then we go into an encounter with the other in a freed by grace spirit. And there's the Lutheran, not that's in me, but that I am in, talking. The overarching aegis is grace, not law. See, you must say it the way that it's been said, and you must find in these other religions exact analogs to your experience. As your experience is normed and mediated by our Lutheran tradition. Because, I mean, how many of us have had a pure religious experience? I mean, you have it as a particular individual. You know, I don't know how to have a Buddhist religious experience. I mean, at the very least, if I were, and I haven't done this, and I should do this, you know, but if I go into a meditation hall of the Buddhists, I would at least be sort of putting aside my Lutheran dogmatic tradition and saying, boy, this is really strange, you know. There's no cross on the wall. And, you know, I would have to do a number on myself. I don't just approach it as sort of universal man, you know, and this is an interesting tradition. And, I mean, the last comment is, there may have to be some things that we get rid of. May have to be some things that we get rid of. In other words, it may not be possible for us to continue to say the things that we've been saying entre nous, in the group, because, as if, you know, this is the Lutheran group and there's the balcony. And I said this Saturday night, this is the correlation between the 2 days. There are Sufi mystics and there are Orthodox doctors of the Sharia from Al-Azhar University who don't get along very well sometimes, you know. So they're up there listening to our dialogue and kind of glancing over at each other saying, I wonder what he's thinking about this Christian stuff about Jesus as final and normative. And there's the Hindu saying, well, you know, my dogma says that they're all final and normative and there's no problem, but gee, I better look at this again. You know, and there's the Buddhist saying, well, they're pretty substantialist down there, you know, and I believe in emptiness as the reality. But maybe I'm going to have to think about that again. In other words, strictly intra-Christian talk is want, no longer possible for people who take what these people are saying seriously. Yeah, Mark.
I get a feeling, too, from Berger's session this morning, is that what we're engaged in now is not any different from, in one sense, than what Christianity has been doing, or Judaism has been doing since the beginning of meeting different cultures, having people coming from different origins, and working with the scriptures, the texts, and they change through time. There's thousands of manuscripts of the Bible, and they're changed through time, and certain canonical folks choose these. I mean, this seems to be just another kind of process like that. Is that seeming?
I might add a footnote to that, simply say that there are many Christianities. There's not a single Christian religion. Yeah. There are many Christianities. Mm-hmm. And in fact, even within the New Testament, there are a number of Christianities already reflected. But this, of course, is burgeoned in the 2000 years of history.
Yeah.
That's what makes it hard for other cultures to study us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are Buddhisms, and there are Islams, and Confucian. There's a Neo-Confucian movement. My gosh, we haven't even figured out what Confucianism is. Now there's a Neo. Oh my gosh. Well, I'll tell you what, it's 4 minutes before the 12:45 when we're supposed to eat, is that correct? Is that when we have lunch? And the tape is doubtless over, so those of you who want to get out of here a little early can, and the rest you can stay until we hear the bell when I'm out of here. You can stay.
Yeah.
Thank you.